Welcome to the Arizona Taxes Show.
It's the show about everything,
including the things that we can't mention.
Do you know what we're talking about? Because if you do, let us know and hurry.
Broadcasting live from the Empire State Building in the heart of New York City, the Eric Metaxas Show.
Now your host, until further notice, Eric Metaxas.
Well, hello there. Hello, hello, hello. We are talking about everything. On this show, you know, if you listen, we talk about everything. And under the rubric of everything, under the aegis of all things, falls what I like to call nonfiction. We have here in the studio in New York City, Nathaniel Philbrick. You may recognize that name. He is an acclaimed author, acclaimed by all the right people. Yours truly, of course, at the top of that list. He has won the National Book Award for his book, In the Heart of the Sea, Holy Cow, which was made into a movie recently by Ron Howard. That is a book that I have read and enjoyed thoroughly, disturbing and amazing as it was. And there is a new book just out called Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Nat Philbrick, since you allow me to call you Nat, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
It's great to be here.
Well, it is my joy. I was saying to you earlier, it really is very rare that I get to talk to someone whose books I have read and thoroughly enjoyed. People always come up to me and tell me about my books, and I'm thrilled that they've read my books. And I think I would feel that way if I were talking to someone whose books I had read and enjoyed, but they're all dead, except for a few people who I haven't met yet, but now I've met you.
And well, great. Well, it means a lot coming from you.
Well,
I mean it.
Your book, In the Heart of the Sea, it's one of those rare things. I was actually in Nantucket. I know you live in Nantucket.
Yep.
I was in Nantucket about 2 years ago, staying there, and on the bedstand, I think, there was a book, and it was In the Heart of the Sea. And I thought, you know, I've always wondered about the source material for Moby Dick and, you know, just the Essex. You can talk about that. But I knew that the story of the Essex was part of what led Herman Melville to write Moby Dick. And I thought, what about that? So I just picked the book up and started reading it. And I rarely do that, you know.
Yeah.
But I was absolutely captivated, not just by the story, but by your writing. And I am a very fussy writer and reader. So, yes, that's a high compliment, I would say, coming from me. It was a joy. And then, of course, I had to pick up the book that you wrote, How to Read. I'm sorry, what was it? The Moby Dick book. Why Read Moby Dick, which I also absolutely loved. And so it really is a pleasure. It was a pleasure to find out that you're out with a new book on a subject I know something about, George Washington and the Revolution, but even a greater joy to be sitting here with you.
Well, great. Well, it really is mutual.
Well, so thank you so much for being here, and tell us about this new book. I know the book just came out, and since you're a big deal author, it's got to be doing well. People are now. I know that Michiko Kakutani gave it a sneering, unpleasant review.
Janet Maslin. Actually.
Oh, it was Janet Maslin?
Yes,
I get them confused. One of them is sneering, and the other. No, never mind. But it was kind of a sneering review, and so I dismissed it. But honestly, this is a fascinating subject, Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. So tell us, what led you, first of all, to write this book?
Well, you know, it was about 25 years ago when I began researching the history of where I live, Nantucket Island, that I came across one of the great books about the 18th century. It's Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur's Letters from an American Farmer. And it's the best book there is in the 18th century about America. He was a Frenchman who became a naturalized American citizen just before the Revolution. Loved the country. You know,
What is his name again?
Crèvecoeur is his last name. And he was a petty nobleman who had fought in the French and Indian War and somehow ended up in America. He traveled all over the country, went down the Mississippi, up and down the Eastern Seaboard. He went to Nantucket a lot. And so that's why I was reading this. And he famously asks, what is this American, this new man? He was fascinated with a country where people from different cultures, economic, you know, could get together and create a new society. And he was in love with it. And then the Revolution breaks out. and it's destroyed. Suddenly, patriot ideologues move into town, intimidating people who are not sure which side they're on, especially if they're loyalists, taking their property. It's just, he's, you know, what is going on here? And so he ends up abandoning America and making his way back to France. And in his final letter is this, it's this cry in the dark. You know, oh my gosh, look what's happened to what I was so in love with. And that was a side of the revolution I had never heard about.
Of course not. You're not going to hear about that
side. No, no. You know, you hear about it's a group of rambunctious militiamen who band together filled with patriotic ideals and defeat the mightiest power on earth and throw off the shackles of British tyranny. And that's kind of what I thought it was. And so this was a new side to it. And my previous book is called Bunker Hill, and it's about the beginning of the revolution and takes it through the siege of Boston, where Washington becomes the commander of the new Continental Army. And I was just fascinated with Washington. I mean, you know, this is not the guy on the dollar bill. This is a guy in his 40s, reddish hair, fiery. And, you know, and I was surprised by that, you know, because I had thought of him as a staid pragmatist, the rock upon which we put our country. But no, this was a different guy. He wanted to attack the British in Boston, wipe it out, just end this thing quickly. But it was too risky, and so his council of war always said, wait, wait, wait. And so I really wanted to follow him into the revolution. And so I said, if I'm following Washington, how do I get into that dark side? You know, how do I reveal it? Well, you know, who is the character that can really make me penetrate the myths? Well, it's Benedict Arnold.
Yeah. What a fascinating figure. I mean, it's just most people only know of him as Benedict Arnold the traitor.
Yes.
But when you realize that he was a great hero of the revolution before he became a traitor, it's all the more horrific.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's very easy if you think he was evil from the start to dismiss this. Okay, yeah, his true colors were revealed, but it's not that simple. He was our best general. He donated a lot of his personal fortune to the cause. He was never compensated, and he gets his left leg injured grievously twice. And he's always impressive on the battlefield more than anyone else. And he becomes disillusioned, you know, as he watches the dark side of the revolution, as he sees this people who were filled with unanimous search for liberty, beginning to lose their way, you know, self-interest taking over. And what happened was a kind of civil war erupted within the country. You know, instead of putting all our energies in fighting the British, we were actually fighting ourselves. You know, if you look to north of New York in Westchester County, where neither army held sway. New York was occupied by the British. The Americans were to the north and around the Hudson. There were gangs of if they were patriots, they called themselves cowboys. If they were loyalists, they called themselves skinners. And they just fought it out, pillaging the homes of former neighbors, all in the cause of so-called the higher cause. But it was a sordid kind of warfare. And the same thing was happening in coastal New Jersey and Long Island. They called it the whaleboat wars, where dispossessed patriots from Long Island who were now in Connecticut would load up soldiers into the whaleboats and come down and attack their former homes and literally rape and pillage their neighbors. And so this was going on. It was just all the Continental Congress couldn't get its act together. It had no direct taxing power. It was just making it up as it went along. And factionalism, you know, it's nothing new in Congress. Right. They were fighting over insignificant issues. And Arnold was not the only one who was becoming concerned that, the country was losing its way.
It is extraordinary to hear the other side of the story and see how. So the question when we come back from the break, I want to ask you, what was it that made Washington, whom I admire, I've written about him, I admire him greatly. What was it that you think caused him to sort of, you know, hold the line ideologically and cause Benedict Arnold to fold and go to the other side? So when we come back, we are talking to Nathaniel Philbrick, the celebrated author, National Book Award winner. New book is Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. We'll be right back. And now a little KC and the Sunshine Band.
Thank you. and sundials. Susie was in pigtails. I know I love her even then. You know my papa disapproved it.
Folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. Stevie Wonder, he's not in the studio, but in the studio is the author, Nathaniel Philbrick. You may know him from his previous books, big New York Times bestseller, National Book Award winner, In the Heart of the Sea. Great book, which I have read and thoroughly enjoyed, and many, many others, including Why Read Moby Dick, another book that I enjoyed thoroughly. The new book is Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, no Oxford comma, and the fate of the American Revolution. We'll debate the Oxford comma another time with your editor and my editor, Brian Tart. But my question before we went to the break was, why do you think, you know, because when you hear about the dark side of war and you realize how complicated it is, it's not simple. Why do some people, most notably Washington, they hold the line? They say, in spite of all this, we know we must do this. What do you think it was that separated them in this incredible way?
Yeah, I think it comes down to character, really. Both Washington and Arnold were wired in a similar way in that they were both by nature, natural temperament, aggressive on the battlefield. Washington would adjust that as he began to realize this isn't working for me in the revolution, because he had the ability to see outside his own impulsive demands of his own self. Rules mattered to him. And he knew that if this revolution was going to be successful and we were going to create a republic, that the civil government had to have control over the military. And every other revolution before this, whether it was the Roman, Caesar, English Revolution, Cromwell, the military had taken over,
of course,
the government in the chaos that follows the revolution. And if this experiment was going to work, the leader of the army had to toe that line.
Yeah.
And he was – I mean, it was – he had the patience of Job, because the Continental Congress was basically dysfunctional.
Yep.
They were second guessing him all the way. He had officers who were trying to jockey and take over from him. All of this, I mean, just about anyone else would have either walked away from it or said a coup is the only thing that's going to save it. He didn't. And I think it comes down to the fact that he could recognize it may not be what necessarily I would like to do, but it's the best thing for this country. And that takes an extraordinary man.
Oh, I mean, you know, I've actually written about this now twice in my books, and I find it to be extraordinary that every school child is not taught this, because this is a spectacular display of character and self-control. I mean, the idea that he was able to govern himself. Obviously, without people governing themselves, you can't have self-government. I mean,
it
will not work. He lived it out. He modeled it in a way that almost no one around him – I mean, obviously, you know, in 1783, you know, when they were circulating the letter, we'll make you King George the First of America. And he was mortified at that idea.
Right. Because all he had fought for would have been thrown out the window. And I mean, it is extraordinary. And you know, because I think it came from him personally. He was by nature, you know, his anger issues that when he was a teenager were huge.
Yeah.
And he realized this is going to be a problem for me. And, you know, so he copied out those rules of civility.
Yeah.
You know, he realized, wait a minute, I really have to adjust myself here. And that's extraordinary. Most of us are who we are.
Right.
And when things don't go well, we blame everyone else. We don't necessarily look at the mirror.
I know that's true of you, Nat. I've talked to people around you, and you've got to change. No, it's funny. You're right, because when you look at Benedict Arnold, it reminds me, of course, of, you know, Milton's Paradise Lost, the romantic figure of Satan, right?
Yeah.
Satan has a lot of good complaints, right?
Absolutely.
And
he's a very charismatic figure.
And that reminds me, when I think of Benedict Arnold, it's that kind of a thing. That
it's
pride
really
was injured, Miltonic. There you go. That's precisely right. So tell us a little bit about Arnold, those of us who don't know.
Okay. Well, so his record in the first years of the war was incredible. He came up with the idea of taking Fort Ticonderoga almost as soon as the revolution broke out. He would then march up to Quebec through the Maine wilderness that won him the title of the American Hannibal. And then, and, you know, and he was also a mariner, which I really didn't appreciate. And I know I'm a maritime guy, but he fought one of the most brilliant sea battles on Lake Champlain.
I mean, that's incredible right there. The idea of a sea battle on Lake Champlain.
Yeah. Oh, it boggles the mind. It was the Battle of Valcour Island, just below Plattsburgh, New York today.
Mm-hmm.
And Washington had lost New York. The British, and there's a river waterway. If you take the Hudson, go up past Albany, little jog to Lake Champlain, it goes all the way to Canada. And if the British got control of that, they would divide New England from the rest of the country, and they'd have it. And so
there's no connection to the St. Lawrence waterway up there.
Yes, there is.
There is.
Lake Champlain flows through the Richelieu River into the St. Lawrence. And so it's pretty much a line down. And this is when you couldn't travel by land. And so you had to move by water. And so the British have New York. They have access from the south. There's a fleet almost at the same time coming down from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Huge force that they had put together. And the only one between stopping them and potentially losing the war to the British is Benedict Arnold in a fleet of 15 vessels that he's built that summer, and this is the summer of 1776, they're basically floating platforms for cannons. They called them gondolas and galleys, you know, with oars. And he's got, you know, how is he going to defend this, you know, go against this huge British fleet? Well, he puts his fleet inside Valcour Bay, which is right on the western shore of Lake Champlain, and has the British come up against him, against the wind. He waits till they sail past, and then it's the water equivalent of the high ground, and he fights them to a draw, a really bloody 8-hour battle where they're just blowing at each other cannon-wise. I mean, it's just, and at night comes, he's able to escape. One more little battle, and what he's done is he's convinced the British it's too late in the year to take Fort Ticonderoga. They'll wait till next year. And so he's saved the country, and he set up what will ultimately be a year later, the Battle of Saratoga, the great victory in which he will fight heroically and which will ultimately bring the French into the revolution. And it's all Benedict Arnold. And so, you know, he was not only charismatic, he had an incredibly instinctive military genius. He could see an enemy and almost immediately see the strengths, the weaknesses, and what he should do, you know. And, but the problem is he had these, he was great in a battlefield situation, but when not, he couldn't control those passions, and he would rub his officers the wrong way. Politicians drove him absolutely insane. And so there was always controversy wherever he went. And, you know, and to add to this, you know, he is clearly in those first 2 years our best general in the battlefield. And the Continental Congress in the winter of 1777, by this time Washington has turned it around with Trenton and Princeton. The Continental Congress, because they have to control the military, decides that they will appoint Washington's major generals. And the highest ranking brigadier is Arnold. No one has a better record. And they decide they've got a quota system. Each state will have two major generals. Connecticut, Arnold's state, already has two. And then that means he's overlooked. And five brigadier generals below him pass him to major general. I mean, it's
the kind of thing
yep.
of which Shakespearean tragedy is made.
Exactly. And Washington was horrified.
Yeah.
You know, he had no clue this was coming. And this begins it. You know, Arnold begins, you know, what am I doing this for? If, you know, this is the kind of reception I get. And so he begins to question, you know, what is the government? You know, what are we doing here? Is this good for us? And, you know, to top it all off, the next year with the Battle of Saratoga, he gets in this big battle with Horatio Gates, a general who was not Washington's best friend, was positioning himself to potentially take over after Washington suffers the loss of Philadelphia to the British. And they have a huge blow up. He gets kicked out of the army, but appears on the battlefield for the final climactic
Gates
battle.
Gates does?
No, I'm sorry, Arnold.
Yeah.
And he's not in control of any you know, he's a rogue agent, and people follow him because he's this charismatic figure, And, you know, it's going our way, but he sees a way to end it and leads this desperate charge around to the back of a British redoubt, storms through the sally port in the back, you know, waves his sword, says surrender. A German soldier fires his musket, hits the leg that he's already injured at Quebec, that kills the horse that collapses on his leg. And as he will say to one of his good friends, I wish the musket ball had gone through my heart.
Wow, we will be right back. You've got a talent for storytelling. You should go professional, Nat Philbrick. We're going to be right back talking to Nathaniel Philbrick about the new book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Stick around.
Our love is like a ship on the ocean. We've been sailing
folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. Boogie nights are always the best in town. Nathaniel Philbrick sitting here with me in the studio. Wouldn't you agree that boogie nights are always the best in town?
They have been since the 70s.
Typically. Yeah, typically, yeah. They're always the best in town. We're talking this minute with Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Just a fascinating story, and what you just told us before the break, that it's inconceivable to me that Benedict Arnold would, on his own, take that step at Saratoga. As you said, he was under no one's authority. I don't quite understand
what
how he could be the hero of Saratoga if he's actually out of the army.
Yes, what had happened was there are two battles to Saratoga. The first one was the Battle of Freeman's Farm, and it's Arnold's soldiers that fight the British to a draw, inflict terrible casualties on them, and you know, and Gates, who is fearful that Arnold will steal his thunder, his official report of the battle makes no mention of Arnold, and so they get real. Arnold gets upset, and Arnold is a passionate person, not tactful. They have it out, and ultimately Gates says, "Fine, if you're not happy, you're out of here. You know, go help Washington to the south." And there's a petition that's almost put together, the officer saying, don't leave us. You know, you're the one why we did so right, well the first right. battle. He's thinking he's going to leave. Finally decides, I guess I'll stick around. And so he has no official role. And so the battle breaks out and he appears on the battlefield. Some said he was running around more like a madman than a discreet officer. And he was upset and, yeah. you know, but that didn't mean, you know, he recognized what was needed to do on the battlefield. And so he, you know, at the end of the battle, he really is the one that, turns it around by taking this redoubt, but in the process, he multiple fractures in his leg, and this is a guy. He's an athlete. He's someone for whom his athleticism is an absolute essential part of him, and they want to cut the leg off.
Oh.
And he says no, but he's in a bed for 3 or 4 months. In this medieval torture device, the equivalent of a fracture box, and so he could not. He was in a bed. He could not see. He was so immobile he couldn't write letters, and he just brooded over the fact that Horatio Gates had screwed him over. He would say to Lafayette, Gates is the greatest poltroon in the world. And while Arnold is recovering in Albany, Gates has gone south to Philadelphia, where he will become the center of what's called the Conway Cabal. There's a group in Congress that thinks since Washington has suffered all these reversals with the loss of Philadelphia to the British, while Gates has suffered this, has enjoyed this huge victory at Saratoga, well, maybe we should have Gates as the head. The irony here is that Gates' great reputation was based very much on what Arnold had accomplished. And so I think from Washington's point of view, he was a political genius. You could argue he was a better politician. In fact, he was a better yeah. politician than he was a general. He handles it very well and he emerges from it. But I think he could really sympathize with Arnold, yeah. Someone who is you know, being unfairly treated, even though he's trying to do the best thing. And this would create a kind of blind spot, I think, when it came to Washington ultimately, when he just never saw it coming as Arnold became more and more embittered.
Yeah.
And
well, it's a funny thing, though, because it's one thing when you you become embittered. We can understand his bitterness. But the idea that he would at some point turn and, I mean, especially having done all he had done for, you know, his
right. What, how could you get to the, reach the point?
So what do you think at that moment? In other words, at what point does he make this decision? Was it I don't remember the story. I'm sure I've heard it at some point. But where was he in life at the point that he decides to go over to the dark side?
Well, he comes down to Valley Forge in the spring, just before the British evacuate Philadelphia. Because what happens is the French come in to the war, meaning that the British are now on the defensive. They need to consolidate their forces in New York. So the order is that Henry Clinton, who's now the head of the British Army, has to leave Philadelphia. And so Washington will follow him back to New York, but he needs to leave someone in control of war-torn Philadelphia. And now the Patriots are returning after a winter away. They're very angry at those loyalists who were in British-occupied Philadelphia. You know, street fights are breaking out. Mm-hmm. They need a very diplomatic officer to be in charge of this. He puts Arnold in charge because his leg is so – he can't even walk, so he can't you know, work right. in the military. So as a favor, he says, you be military governor of Philadelphia. Arnold sees this as an opportunity to maybe make some money on the side. So he engages in some not necessarily illegal but secret business deals, taking advantage of the whole movement of people in and out of this city.
Right.
And there is a new head of the Pennsylvania legislature, Joseph Reed, who was a former adjutant general of Washington. Mm-hmm. And they had a falling out. And Reed really doesn't like Arnold.
Gosh.
And he becomes persecuted, and that makes him begin to think, I should go to the other side.
Wow. We're going to be right back to continue this wonderful conversation with Nathaniel Philbrick, author of the new book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. I really look forward to reading this book, having read your previous books. Folks, we will be right back.
Attention. She's poetry in motion, a beautiful sight to see. I get so excited, you and her anatomy.
It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We have to interrupt Casey and the Sunshine Band because I'm trying to have a conversation with Nathaniel Philbrick about his book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. So you were saying that in Philadelphia, Benedict Arnold gets into it with Reed.
Yes.
And so it increases his bitterness. But still, to turn to the other side, what was it, to use a William F. Buckley word, what was the dispositive event or series of events? I that's what fascinates me.
Right.
It's one thing to be really bitter. It's another thing to say, I'm going to the other side.
Right. Well, you know, he begins to think, hey, the British have made it clear by this point that they think he's the best general in America. And here he is being hounded by his own people. He thinks he's being persecuted, and he was.
Now, how have the British made that clear? I'm not.
They're in their loyalist newspaper in New York. All sorts of look at what's happening to that poor American general, the greatest the fangs of the politicians are you know, he's fending himself off. John Burgoyne, who had been the head of the British,
Gentleman Johnny.
Yep, Johnny Burgoyne, who had been the commander at Saratoga, was at that point speaking before Parliament, trying to explain what had happened. And he is saying, if not for Benedict Arnold, I would have won the first Battle of Saratoga. And we would have, you know.
He's flattered.
He's being flattered, and he's just getting eaten alive in Philadelphia. And then you know what happens? He meets a girl.
I was going to say, there's a girl involved.
Yeah,
here.
Right. And he meets an 18-year-old girl, half his age, from Philadelphia aristocracy, named Peggy Shippen. And we know she was beautiful because there's a wonderful sketch of her that had been done by a British officer during the British occupation of Philadelphia the year before, named Major John André. And, you can see from the sketch, she was a very good-looking girl, and Arnold fell in love with her. They court, and while all of this is going on, I mean, so it's, you know, all heck is breaking loose in Philadelphia, but he's in love. He's deciding, maybe I should just leave the military. They get married. A month later, Arnold sends out his first feelers to the British, that goes to New York, where to none other than Major John André, who is now head of the British spy network in New York, and thus begins a correspondence.
So the connection was through Peggy Shippen to André,
right? She knew him,
she was never a loyalist.
And never technically. Her father was desperately trying to straddle the fence. Her younger brother had actually joined the British Army and then said, oops, I was wrong. They were the aristocracy. And after the revolution, it was what they called the constitutionalists, because Pennsylvania had the most radical constitution in the country, where it was majority rules, no governor, legislature rules all, and there were absolutely no provisions to save the rights of the minority. So the fat cats, the aristocracy that had been in power, the Quakers that had been in power who would not sign a loyalty oath, they are basically being persecuted by the lower orders that are now the majority.
Right.
With Arnold siding with the more conservative group.
Right.
And so that's part of the problem he's having with Reed.
And so what was promised him in this deal? In other words, you turn over West Point and we will give you what? I mean, was it that bald?
Yeah, it was. It was a year of negotiation. Initially, Arnold, in a typical way, they say, hey, we're really interested in you. And he says, well, great. I will give you all the information you want if you tell me what you're going to do. And they say, no, it doesn't work that way. Thin-skinned Arnold says, well, the heck with this. And then in the fall of 1779, there is what's called the Battle of Fort Wilson, in which Philadelphians start killing each other in the streets, where radical militiamen attack a home where conservative political American figures, including Judge Wilson and some Continental officers, are holed up. You know, it's come down to this. The country, we're fighting ourselves.
That is extraordinary. One never hears of that.
Oh, no,
I have
no.
to say, I've never
and
heard
Joseph
that.
Reed, men would get killed. And Joseph Reed, when he heard about that, dismissed them as the casual overflowings of liberty. Now, Arnold.
That's called collateral damage.
Exactly.
Circa 1779.
Yep. And so Arnold tries to come to the aid of those that are besieged in his carriage. He can't yet ride a horse, and he's attacked by a mob. And it's within a month of that they, with Peggy, with a letter to André, they resume the negotiations. And then it's a matter of Arnold saying, okay, since I can't lead people in battle, maybe I can get command of West Point, which is now the important.
Get command of West Point for the British.
Well, yeah, he will be selected as the American commander and then work it out so that he'll turn it over to the British when they come up the river and attack it.
better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. I have to say, this is so extraordinary that he would do that.
Yeah. He had, in fact, there was more than a little narcissism in Benedict Arnold, and I think it contributed to why he was so good on the battlefield. He had a talent to convince himself, if it's right for me, it's right for everyone. You know, look at what this country's doing. It's time to bring in the British so they can restore the freedoms we once had, because it's not happening
right
now.
Right. Yeah, people never say, I'm going over to the evil side.
Right.
They have their reasons, but my goodness. Well, I'm glad we have at least one more short segment with Nathaniel Philbrick. The book is Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. It is so important for us to know our history. I think we can start right there. Valiant Ambition. We'll be right back. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. Our website is metaxastalk.com. If you enjoy this, you can send the podcast to your friends. Please do.
I could feel your heartbeat, and you didn't even say a word. I could feel your heartbeat, and you didn't even say a word. Oh, I know, pretty woman, that you love to be heard.
Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. That's the Partridge Family. I'm talking to Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. I have to ask you, Nathaniel, when this went down, when Andre is caught and Washington realizes what's happened, obviously he has no choice but to brand Arnold a traitor. And I don't remember. Arnold obviously escapes.
Right. Arnold escapes. It's cloak and dagger stuff. Arnold and Andre have this midnight meeting on the west bank of the Hudson. And Andre is about to go back to New York in this very appropriately named vessel, the Vulture. But an American officer, unknown to Arnold, at dawn fires on the vessel, forcing it down the river. Now Andre must make his way through that neutral ground I was talking about of Westchester County back to the British, and he's ultimately captured, and he's holding documents that Arnold has provided him, and word and what's Arnold at this point is in a headquarters house just a mile below West Point on the east side of the Hudson. And Washington is due to visit him on his way back from a meeting with French Rochambeau in Hartford. And Arnold gets word of Andre's capture minutes before Washington appears. He goes upstairs to where Peggy is with their infant son and tells her. And he says, you know, I'm out of here. He jumps in his barge. They start rowing down the Hudson. He gets on the Vulture, which has now come back, and escapes to New York. Washington arrives, and he finds out, and he's with Hamilton, he's with Lafayette and Knox. I mean, it's a who's who. Mm-hmm. He finds out that his best general basically has tried to turn West Point over to the British, and he turns to Lafayette, who's now a surrogate son to him,
yeah,
and says, "Whom can we trust now?" I mean, it just hit him, and it was very personal. And it's interesting, you know, after this, Andre is hanged, but for Washington, it becomes personal now.
Yeah.
I am going to get you, Arnold. And so he sends someone into New York to capture Arnold, not to kill him, not to assassinate him, but to capture him, get him across the Hudson where he can be hanged, where he can meet justice. And it doesn't work out for a variety of reasons. But, you know, the great and tragic irony of Arnold's life is it's his treason that galvanizes the American cause. You know, it was so bad that it looked like if Washington should win, there wouldn't be a country left to claim victory. Arnold changes all that. Suddenly, he's burned an effigy in every town up and down.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Coast, and people say, "Oh my gosh, the War of Independence is ours to lose." And it's Arnold that alerts them to it. And you know, he becomes the devil in our own myth of creation. You know,
wow.
He, you know, and
that's quite right.
And so you could say as a battlefield general and as a traitor, no one short of Washington did more to serve the American cause.
Oh, unbelievable. What a joy to have this time with you, Nathaniel Philbrick. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Oh, it's been really fun.
Well, folks, that's the show. The book again, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution, published by Viking Press. Keep listening, and thank you for listening. We appreciate it.